From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as Donald Trump wraps up his first week as president, he's just wrapped up his first public event with a foreign leader. President Trump and British Prime Minister Theresa May held a joint press conference earlier today in which they discussed what May called the special relationship between the two countries. Joining us now is NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And a few pieces of news from this press conference. Let's go through them. First of all, in her opening statement, Theresa May said that Trump supported NATO, an organization that he has criticized extensively in the past. Here she is.
We've reaffirmed our unshakable commitment to this alliance. Mr. President, I think you said you confirmed that you're 100% behind NATO. But we're also discussing the importance of NATO continuing to ensure it is as equipped to fight terrorism and cyber warfare as it is to fight more conventional forms of war. And I've agreed to continue my efforts to encourage my fellow European leaders to deliver on their commitments to spend 2% of their GDP on defence so that the burden is more fairly shared.
Now, Domenico, it is different to have the British Prime Minister say that Trump has confirmed his 100% commitment to NATO and have Trump actually say that himself, which he didn't. But what do you make of that?
Yeah, he didn't disagree with her, but he also didn't chime in and say, absolutely, 100% behind. Yeah, Trump has seemed to evolve on this issue. You know, during the campaign, he said NATO was obsolete, was critical of other countries for not spending enough. But after meeting with President Obama, talking with Secretary of Defense, now Secretary of Defense James Mattis, and meeting and listening to other allies, it seems that Trump has sort of toned down the rhetoric on NATO a bit. You know, it meant more. You know, it would have obviously meant more had Trump said it, but maybe it's like torture in the way that, you know, he's okay with NATO, but doesn't quite like it.
Well, let's talk about the issue of torture, because that came up as well. Trump was asked a question by a British reporter on his views on torture. This is how he responded.
We have a great general who has just been appointed Secretary of Defense, General James Mattis, and he has stated publicly that he does not necessarily believe in torture or waterboarding or however you want to define it. Enhanced interrogation, I guess, would be a word that a lot of people would like to use. I don't necessarily agree, but I would tell you that he will override because I'm giving him that power.
So is that the end of this discussion that has been going on for several days now about whether the U.S. is going to bring back torture because Trump says that Mattis will override?
Maybe in the short term, but I really don't think in the long term. I mean, he's really trying to have it both ways. You know, he's trying to look tough by saying that he's for it, but that he won't violate laws, the Army Field Manual. But he leaves the door open in the way he talks about this. And I do wonder what happens when or if there's an attack on the country or if there's a different Secretary of Defense or if Trump feels like he's not getting his way, that there he's still leaving that door open for a policy change.
We also got news today that Trump had a phone call with the Mexican president Enrique Peña Nieto that he claimed was amicable and went on for about an hour. This after, of course, Trump said he wants Mexico to pay for the wall. Mexico said, we're not paying for the wall. Then the meeting that the two leaders were supposed to have next week was canceled and Trump threatened a 20% border tax. What's going on or what do we know about the latest state of yeah. U.S.-Mexico relations?
Well, they're not in the best place that they've ever been, and clearly Donald Trump wanted to show that he was going to follow through at least on pushing for this wall. You mentioned the 20% import tax that was floated by his press secretary Sean Spicer. Hours later, the White House walked that back and said maybe it could be you know, a 15% tax, maybe it would be an 8% tax. The point Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, was trying to make, he said, was that it could be paid for. Now, that does not mean that Mexico is paying for it. That would mean U.S. consumers are paying for it through increases in prices, most likely, of Mexican imports. And there are a lot of things that the United States imports from Mexico, from cars to electronics, never mind avocados and margaritas, you know.
Right. So we got one other piece of news, Domenico, a small thing maybe, but it's important. Trump has been invited to the U.K. for a state visit with the Queen, and he has accepted that invitation. But how did he do in his – just in the 30 seconds we have left, how did he do in his first meeting with a foreign leader?
You know, clearly Theresa May had an agenda. She had three specific things she wanted to get to. She wanted a commitment on NATO. She wanted a commitment on a potential trade deal. And she wanted to say that she was against Russia sanctions unless Russia came to the table on some specific details.
Right.
Donald Trump, on the other hand, lots of platitudes and frankly seemed a little bit nervous, a little unsteady. Maybe he'll find his sea legs, but this was the first shot.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR political editor. Domenico, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a closer look now at that piece of U.S. diplomacy that was carried out this week on Twitter. Let's set the scene. The Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, was preparing to travel to Washington to begin negotiations on reworking U.S.-Mexico relations when Donald Trump sent out that tweet on Tuesday. "Big security day coming," he wrote, "and we will build the wall." On Wednesday, Peña Nieto's people met with the White House and, according to the Wall Street Journal, told them that if an executive order includes building the wall and Mexico paying for it, the president of Mexico will have to cancel the meeting. Then yesterday morning, Trump tweeted out, "If Mexico is unwilling to pay for the wall, maybe it's better to cancel the upcoming meeting." A few minutes later, Peña Nieto took to Twitter and, in effect, canceled the meeting. Femi Oke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us from Washington. And Femi, this has just been extraordinary.
Diplomacy via Twitter. Who would have thought that this would be possible? But hey, it's 2017.
It is. And it is this administration with Donald Trump, who has two Twitter handles, one POTUS and one he's kept the real Donald Trump. So he has two. What has caught your eye about the way this U.S.-Mexico story is unfolded?
I have been following the former president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, and he has been very candid, very frank, very direct, very colourful in his use of language. So he has a lot of Twitter fans. So when this idea of the wall, it resurfaced after President Trump's inauguration, this is what Vicente Fox said: "Mexico won't pay for your wall. You say that America won't neither. Then who's left? It's you and your bleep wall. Hashtag bleep war." And then there's a number of conversations below that. Here's at Robbie Starbuck. This is the against. "The peso is crashing right now. Trump called your bluff. Mexico needs the US 1,000 times more than we need you." And then this is from a sample from the other side. Zadria Bogner says, "A Vicente Foxke, everyone in America loves your stand against at real Donald Trump. You are now our hero." And so it continues. Take a look at hashtag bleep wall. It gives you some idea of the for and against for the war between the US and Mexico.
Well, it's also an amazing part of this. Not only are lawmakers talking to each other and world leaders talking to each other now through Twitter, but ordinary citizens are joining in the debate on social media. Let's move to another big debate this week, the reaction to the memo from the Trump administration to a number of federal agencies, including the EPA and the Department of the Interior, telling them they can't send out social media posts or news releases. Talk a little bit about this and the accounts that have sprung up, these rogue Twitter accounts.
There's a couple of accounts that have popped up this week, and in direct relation to it's a temporary ban on communications while the new administration gets bedded down. It's been seen, depending on what side of the aisle that you sit at, as a gag order, but it often happens between one administration changing to another administration. But that hasn't stopped some rogue accounts setting up or unofficial accounts. So they're related to federal agencies, but and apparently run by members of staff for the federal agencies, but they are not the official account. I'll give you a couple to look up because there's humor, there's wit, at actual EPA facts, at Alt NASA, and at Alt Nat Park, sir. And then you'll get this sense of environment and science and pushback to this very memorable week of this new administration.
Okay, real quick, we want to just touch on a last story that burst into social media. The video posted online of Richard Spencer. Now, this is the man who calls himself a white nationalist. Others call him a white supremacist. We saw that meeting that he had in Washington, D.C. He's been called by his critics racist, anti-Semitic. He claims to have coined the term alt-right. And in that gathering in Washington, D.C., his followers raised their arm what appeared to be a Nazi salute. And so people at the inauguration, he attended the inauguration, asked if he was a neo-Nazi. Let's listen.
"Neo-Nazis don't love me. They kind of hate me, actually.
The KKK neo-Nazis.
They, those people don't like me.
Are you like the hipster version of the neo-Nazi movement?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol."
Well, what you're hearing there is someone came up and punched him in the face. it doesn't matter what you think of somebody, that was pretty horrific to see. But what's happening online?
Immediately there was reaction. So from the alt-right, there was, see, this is what happens when liberals can't control themselves. And then from the liberal side of the debate online, there was hashtag punch a Nazi, an ethical debate about whether it's okay to punch a Nazi. So people were saying, what would Harry Potter do? Captain America, that was Captain America's job. And meanwhile, if you have a look at Richard Spencer's Twitter account, it's at Richard Spencer, very easy to find. He's pinned a video response to the conversation about the ethics of punching him. But even underneath that, he's being trolled and people are celebrating the fact that from time to time, people like to punch him in the face. To be continued.
Yeah, it's not the first time that's happened. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day around the globe for people to remember the atrocities committed over seven decades ago in Nazi Germany. In Chicago, there's a home that houses some of the last generation of Holocaust survivors. The self-help home was originally set up after World War II as a place for Jewish refugees who managed to escape Nazi-occupied Europe with their lives. In 2014, we met two residents of that home, starting with Edith Stern, now in her 90s. She worked at the home when she first arrived in Chicago after surviving the Auschwitz concentration camp. I asked her how she came to work there.
First of all, a self-help home was founded for people who were persecuted by the Nazis. I'm talking about the people who were able to, they were able to leave Germany without going into concentration camps. And then they came, they also came with their parents, these old people. They knew that when they came here, that they had to work. But they were also aware of the fact that those old people were not able to work anymore. And they were trying to find a place where they could stay, a retirement place. And so it was possible to buy this property for relatively little money. And that was self-help.
And why did you decide to move there?
I survived the Holocaust. And I ended up in Chicago because my sister was here. That's another story. And they needed somebody who would be, who would administer this home. I was in my 40s at that time, okay? I was relatively young. And the reason why I really wanted to work there was because I could never do anything for my own parents. Mm. They were killed. Those people who now lived in this retirement home in self-help could have been my parents, age-wise. And I wanted to do something for them which I never could do for my own.
Why do you think it is important for survivors to be with each other?
Because they had the same experience. They were from the same country. They spoke the same language because, again, I have to say something. Those old people, very few of them spoke English. They spoke German. And old people, as perhaps you know, have difficulties to learn a foreign language, okay? So another thing, when they asked, when I applied for the job and they interviewed me for the job, and I am really from Czechoslovakia. I'm not from Germany. They didn't ask me, the people who interviewed me, whether I speak English. But they asked me whether I speak German because I came from another country. I didn't come from Germany. I speak just as well German because my father was from Vienna. So I speak both languages.
As Holocaust survivors get older,
it becomes more important, it seems, for people to hear these stories, though, these stories of survival from the Holocaust.
Why I think it's important, the reason why I think it's important that we, if people ask us, that we talk about it, because we were there. We are not people who heard about it. I was there. And I think it's important that people don't forget. And we are the last, really the last generation of survivors. If the Holocaust brought anything positive, I hoped, would be that people would remember and fight against discrimination and against hatred. Because I think hatred is the biggest, it's the biggest arm against each other. Because when you hate, you hurt yourself. You don't only hurt the next person, the person whom you hate, but you hurt yourself. That's how I look at it. I don't know whether you understand what I'm saying, but that's,
I do.
That's my philosophy.
I do understand, and I think our listeners understand as well. Is there anything that you would like people to know, though, about where you find yourself now in this self-help home in Chicago and why that's valuable to you?
I entered the self-help home because I knew that that would be the last place I would live in. Most of the people there had a very similar experience. They also came from Europe. They also suffered. And we had very much in common, and I felt I was at home.
It's good to have people who know what you've been through
yes,
there with you.
In a way, yes. Even if they, if not, then there were not too many who were survivors, but there were all who were persecuted by the Nazis, and they had to leave their life, so to say, and start again from the beginning. The new life in America. Yeah. And that was what brought us close.
That was Edith Stern, a resident at the self-help home in Chicago and a survivor of Auschwitz. Another resident of the home that we spoke with in 2014 is Holocaust survivor Margie Oppenheimer. I began by asking her whether she ever talked with other survivors in the home about the Holocaust.
Actually, telling you the truth, we do not talk about the past that much, if we talk at all about the past. We mention it occasionally, but really, telling you the truth, I don't talk much about it unless I'm asked and then I answer questions.
Why is that?
That's the way I am. I mention I was in the camp and that's it. If they ask more questions, then I will answer them.
Do you find comfort, though, in being around other people who have been through similar horrors?
Of course. It helps. And we are treated like human beings with dignity and pride, and we are cared for like we are special, and we have lots of programs, and they help us to stay alive.
And I know that during the Holocaust, there were many moments that you couldn't believe that you were still alive.
I know. At one point, I wasn't supposed to be alive anymore, but we were in the camp, and we had roll call every day. But this time, we had roll call. They took us to a huge open field, and I thought that the open field was the one where they would kill us now. And then we had to undress naked and march in front of all the dignitaries and all the guards and everything. You know, they made their remarks. And then if you were able to work, they put like a one Roman numeral on my left arm, or if I were able to work, they would put two numerals on my left arm. Well, I was very skinny, and I was always very tiny, so I was not able to work anymore in their eyes. So I was marked to be killed and separated from my two friends. And at night, in the evening, it was still light, And I was standing by the fence and looking, and there wasn't a soul on the whole place where people could walk. But then my two friends came, and we didn't speak. They came to me. I fell down. They pulled me underneath the electric fence to the other side. And I swear to God, it was a God's miracle, because I didn't get touched by the electric wiring, and nobody saw me, and we ran to their barracks. I tried to clean off the one mark on my left arm, and so I was free, at least for the night.
Wow.
And then that's how I was saved. But then the next morning we had roll call again, and the commandant said, there's one person too much. Who is that person? Well, I knew very well I was that person, but I was standing behind a very tall lady and hiding, and my cheeks were probably red like tomatoes because they felt like they were on fire. And again he asked, again and again and again, and nobody came forward. So then he took some lady and said, you go to the right. So instead of me, he took another lady, which I still feel guilty about, because I wanted to live and she was killed because of me. And I can't forget it, because I get reminded of that every day.
Our conversation with Margie Oppenheimer, a Holocaust survivor in her 90s who now lives in the self-help home in Chicago. Before that, we heard from fellow resident and survivor Edith Stern. We checked in with the home today. They told us both Margie and Edith are doing well. It's Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
President Trump has not yet settled on a way to pay for his proposed border wall with Mexico. Estimates run from $12 billion on up. Trump insisted this week that Mexico would pay for it. Mexico refused. Yesterday, the White House floated another idea, a 20% tax on all imports from Mexico into this country. White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus said that was just part of a buffet of ideas. But what would it mean? NPR Sonari Glinton joins us from NPR West in Southern California. Sonari, what would happen if there was this 20% tax?
What would happen is that nothing exported would be taxed, and there would be 20% tax on imports. And what that would do is lower tax rates here and provide cash for the government. That is the argument.
Well, but isn't the argument on the other side that if companies in Mexico are taxed, as you said, 20% to sell things into the U.S., they'll just pass that along to consumers? So some of the cheaper items that come in from Mexico that are sold at places like Walmart will cost more.
That is one of the fears. But the idea of this is also to encourage business to stay in, say, a host country, right? So that makes it easier to export from the U.S. That is the idea of this sort of policy. But it's really broad. I mean, it ends up being really broad and has to be a part of a much larger package to understand.
Well, and let's talk a little more about that bigger package, because, for instance, American companies make things in Mexico, car parts, for instance. So there's a speculation that things like those parts and therefore cars might be more expensive in this country. But former Mexican President Vicente Fox, who's been very colorful in his anger at Donald Trump and the idea of a wall, told NBC's Today Show this morning he does not think Trump will spark what he called a trade war. Let's listen.
I don't think he will do it, because there is so much to lose for United States, starting with 10 million jobs.
Now, Sonari, Bloomberg puts it at about 5 million jobs in the U.S., making things that are sold into Mexico. And if Mexico says, oh, yeah, well, we're going to tax you coming back in, doesn't Vicente Fox have a point?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, just take my world. I, you know, focus on cars a lot. The U.S. Exports about $22 billion in cars to Mexico, and it imports about $75 billion. So that automatically, just in the auto industry, you can see how that could potentially have an effect on the cost of certain things. However, the idea is that it balances out on the other side, meaning more jobs, a healthier economy. That is the principle behind this idea.
Well, and to blur it even more, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research working paper in 2010, about 40% of the content of all the things that Mexico sends to us in the U.S., sells to us in the U.S., 40% originates in the U.S. In other words, is sold to Mexico to make those things. So barley for Mexican beer or, as we said, car parts.
One of those examples is that a Ford F-150, they build some aluminum bodies in Mexico, then they transport them. And with engine parts and things like that, literally a part might go between the U.S. and Mexico, or the U.S., Mexico, then Canada or someplace else multiple times.
So you could be punishing U.S. companies who want to sell things to Mexico to make those things that Mexico would sell back but maybe won't because they're going to be, you know, have an increased 20% tariff. It's fascinating. Sonari Glinton, we will continue to look at this. Thank you so much.
It's always been a pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
The election of Donald Trump has had a big impact on book sales. Demands for titles about social justice and the white working class has surged. One book that's gotten a big bump from Trump's election is over 60 years old and has a very dark theme. From Here and Now contributor KQED in San Francisco, Sam Harnett reports.
Thanks to President Donald Trump, Dog-Eared Books in San Francisco has a whole new section.
So this is the social justice section. It sits up at the very front of the store.
Head book buyer Dan Weiss created it the day after the election. It has books about rural white America, like Strangers in Their Own Land, and ones about activism, like Angela Davis's new book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Other local bookstores like City Lights and Alley Cat Books have also created similar areas.
It's not a selfless gesture. We're making money on it as a store. I don't want to make it sound like we're heroes, because we're not. But it feels good to be able to at least have that, make that information more available.
Weiss says one book people kept telling him to feature was The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. The book has been selling out as fast as the store can get it.
But I was surprised, like, how many people were like, no, this is what you have to read, like, this is what's important, and just, like, quoting it online.
The Origins of Totalitarianism is not typically a hot commodity. It's a dense book of political theory that details what led to the rise of Stalinism and Nazism. But by mid-December, many local bookstores were sold out. Even Amazon briefly ran out of stock.
We could see right after the election, it started to rise.
Jim Elliott is editorial director of Publishers Weekly. He says the book normally sells about 50 copies a week. But at its peak in December, it was selling at 16 times that rate.
Those are very good numbers.
And it's still selling strong. The book has recently been in the top 25 of Amazon's list of movers and shakers, which measures daily uptick in book sales. That's shocking to Roger Berkowitz, founder of the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College.
I mean, this is a 500-page book that's very difficult going at times.
Berkowitz has never seen so much interest in Arendt's work. It makes sense. He says the right-wing populism and dissatisfaction with government that's sweeping Europe and the U.S. is reminiscent of what happened in the 1920s and 30s. Arendt pinpointed three major social problems back then, which Berkowitz says are still relevant today.
Homelessness, rootlessness, and loneliness. Their overarching impact is the same, which is that we live in a world in which people don't feel as if their lives have purpose or meaning.
Arendt said these conditions open the door for totalitarianism, a political system where the state has complete power and establishes a single ideology that people follow en masse. Berkowitz says Trump started a movement with some unsettling characteristics, like how the campaign handled facts, but that Trump is no totalitarian.
Arendt would be the first to point out that we are not living in a totalitarian era right now. That doesn't mean that one can't emerge.
Back at Dog-Eared Books, Dan Weiss is pricing new books. including a copy of The Origins of Totalitarianism. Weiss says uncertainty about the future is a big reason customers are buying challenging books.
People are feeling more commitment, I think, to read things that are difficult right now than they would have before.
Although some customers are steering clear of the real world altogether. Since the election, Weiss says, they've sold quite a few science fiction novels. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett in San Francisco.
Well, another book that has seen a bump in sales is George Orwell's 1949 novel, 1984. This week, 1984 topped Amazon's list of best-selling books, and its publisher ordered a 75,000-copy reprint. So we thought we'd take a closer look at 1984 with Petra Mayer of NPR Books. Hi, Petra.
Hey, Jeremy.
So for people like me who haven't read 1984 in quite some time now, remind us again of the plot of this book.
Sure. This is George Orwell's classic dystopian vision of a future. Well, it was the future when he wrote it in the late 40s, although 1984 is now the past for us. But a future dominated by three giant dystopian totalitarian superstates. And the story takes place in what was then England and is now Airstrip One. Winston Smith is the protagonist. He's kind of a workaday drudge. He works in the party's records department. The party is the organization that runs all of this. And he manipulates reality to suit the party's directives. And he harbors all these rebellious thoughts. And eventually he acts on them. And so the book is about what happens when he meets Julia, who becomes his lover, and they both begin to rebel against the party. And I feel like it's not a spoiler to say it doesn't end well.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why this book has become popular all of a sudden once again is because last weekend, Kellyanne Conway, a senior White House official, went out there and started talking about alternative facts. And a lot of commentators referred to that as Orwellian. Why?
Sure. Orwellian is an adjective that gets tossed around a lot, but that's because it applies very frequently to politics. In this case, one of the threads running throughout the book is the idea that that reality is only what we say it is. And in this case, reality is what the party says it is. So if the party says 2 + 2 = 5, then 2 + 2 = 5. The sort of salient quote from the book is, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. So if you can remake reality according to what you want it to be, then you stay in control. And I think when Kellyanne Conway offered what she called alternative facts, that's where a lot of people's minds went.
Why do you think this book continues to resonate after all these years? It is still often required reading in high school and college classes.
Well, it has so many different layers. I mean, you can look at it on the level of a story, and it's, you know, my story about this book is that I first read it when I was 9 years old. Blame my dad. He handed it to me. It was the summer of 1984, so he thought I was ready to read it. So I read it. I was 9, and I didn't understand any of the political underpinnings, but I understood the story, and I understood the world building. So you can just read it as the tragic story of Winston and Julia. You can read it as a historical document because it was written at the time when, you know, Soviet domination over Eastern Europe was starting to be cemented, and it was definitely a reaction to that. And then you can also read it as a political treatise, you know, by the time I was a teenager, because I kept rereading the book. And if you've read it, you know that the middle sections are full of basically a long political science book describing the underpinnings of this totalitarian state and the party's aims. And there are a lot of things in there that are applicable to a lot of different situations. People talk about, of course, you know, one of the other central tenets of this society is constant surveillance. So that gets tossed around a lot whenever there's an issue with surveillance.
Big Brother is watching you.
Right. Big Brother is watching you. Of course, that's the money quote from the book. So there's just so much in it. It's just this ever unfolding thing that you can keep going back to.
And you went back to it again last night. What was it like to reread it again for this conversation?
It was like visiting an old friend. I mean, an old, weird, grim, depressing friend. But the thing with me for the book is that I find something new every time I reread it. And so this time around, I noticed some parallels between scenes in the beginning and the end of the book that I felt like a dummy for not having noticed
like
before.
Like what?
Oh, in the beginning of the book, Winston remembers seeing some old party cadres in a cafe, sort of after they had been purged and had a show trial and confessed, and then they were broken men and they're sitting in this cafe. and a very specific sequence of events happens. And then it's mirrored at the end of the book where Winston himself, having been, you know, arrested and tortured into subservience, is now sitting in the same cafe with the same expression on his face. And it's a very powerful bookend to the story. And I don't know why that had never stood out to me before, because it's pretty obvious when you read it. But so it's things like that. I always notice something new.
That's Petra Mayer of NPR Books talking with us about George Orwell's 1984, which has shot up to the top of Amazon's best-selling books list. Petra, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Well, 1984 has appeared in popular culture many times since its publication. In the year 1984, there was Apple's groundbreaking Super Bowl ad for the Macintosh computer. That year, there was also the film adaptation of the book, starring John Hurt as Winston and Richard Burton as a high-ranking party member.
There is no loyalty except loyalty to the party. There is no love except love of Big Brother. All competing pleasures we will destroy.
In 1974, David Bowie released Diamond Dogs. The album contains several songs inspired by the George Orwell book, including this one. Someday they won't let you. Now you must agree. The times they are a-telling and the changing isn't free. You've read it in the tea leaves and the tracks are on TV. Beware the savage shore. David Bowie, inspired there by George Orwell's book 1984, which is back at the top of the charts on Amazon.
Haunting old photographs are telling a new story about an unfortunate time for some women in Kansas. The pictures are displayed in a tiny museum next to the state prison in Lansing. C.J. Janovy from Here Now contributor KCUR visited the exhibit and has this story.
The Lansing Historical Museum sits in an old three-room train depot almost within rock-throwing distance of what used to be known as the Kansas State Penitentiary.
I am Jennifer Meyer. I'm the museum site supervisor here at the Lansing Historical Museum.
And the museum's only employee. Not all of her exhibits are about the prison. In the other room, there's a display of historic toys. But I'm here to see a collection of unique photographs, a couple dozen prints of men and women's intake photos, mugshots as they're about to be incarcerated, newly digitized from 100-year-old glass plate negatives.
The quality is actually astounding. It's hard to believe that these people lived so long ago, that they're now dead, have been gone for quite a while, and that these pictures are actually from 1902 or from the 1920s.
Meyer wanted to make it easier to share the photos with the public, so she got help digitizing them from Brian Darby, who was an assistant professor of photography at the University of Kansas. Darby was interested in the project because he likes looking at old photos, but he says these photos were mysterious.
All we have is a face to look at. And, you know, there's sorrow and desperation and these kinds of emotions that you can read from a portrait. It's all speculation at that point. I mean, I really don't know the story of these people. I don't know why they were in prison.
But Darby did notice something.
I was surprised by the number of women. I was surprised by how young a lot of them seemed to be.
The Lansing Historical Museum's Jennifer Meyer wanted to know more about these people, too, and found some stories in old small-town newspapers.
All these women were picked up for lascivious conduct.
Not what you think. Consider the case of Carrie Cox and Mary Walker.
The Columbus Daily Advocate liked to report on kind of mundane things. And so it'd be like, Mary Walker visited her cousin this weekend out of town. And so all the way up to the week prior, the newspaper was reporting these two girls, because they were teenagers, having visited family or going to local dances and in doing things with the community. And then all of a sudden, there's an arrest.
After a raid on a dance hall.
And that dance hall raid was initiated by a doctor who was with the Public Board of Health.
To enforce something called Chapter 205. That was a quarantine law from around World War I to help prevent venereal diseases. A researcher at the University of Kansas named Nikki Perry learned all about it while working on her dissertation.
So during World War I, as the country was enlisting all these men into the armed forces, they found that a pretty hefty portion of the population had syphilis or gonorrhea. And so this was seen as a major public health crisis, but also a national security crisis because they were concerned about keeping the troops fit to fight.
Perry says health officers could detain women for a couple of days and test them if they were suspected of being promiscuous. If they were sentenced under Chapter 205, they were sent to the women's industrial farm.
The women's industrial farm, as a separate women's prison, opened in the spring of 1917, and they only had like 17 inmates or something, a very small number of inmates, because these were just the typical female inmate population from the state. And then Chapter 205 began to be implemented over the summer and into the fall. And by the end of the year, they had almost 400 women.
That influx of female prisoners made Jennifer Meyer wonder about the other spreaders of venereal diseases.
Well, what is the equivalent for men? How many men were incarcerated for violation of Chapter 205? I actually couldn't find any.
Turns out Chapter 205 was really only enforced against women. Besides being rounded up in raids, some of them were turned in out of revenge by their boyfriends after they got in fights. Some had been raped. Some didn't have money, so they'd incarcerate themselves for what was, in the days before penicillin, pretty futile treatment for STDs. They were usually quarantined for 2 or 3 months.
And I hate to admit, you know, I grew up in Kansas, I was educated here, and I was not familiar with what Chapter 205 even was. I guess we just didn't talk about it in history class. It's humbling in a way to see this, because these people look just like you and me.
Nikki Perry had a similar feeling.
The pictures are so, they're such high quality that it makes you feel like you're, that the woman is standing there and you just really want to know even more about their stories. Who were these women? Where did they work? What, you know, were they married? Did they have children?
The answers to those questions may be lost to the ages, but thanks to Meyer's project, we can at least study these women's faces. For Here and Now, I'm CJ Janovy.
What a story. And you can see some of the photos from the Faces of the Kansas State Penitentiary exhibit at herenow.org. But if you happen to be near Lansing, Kansas, the exhibit is on display at the Lansing Historical Museum through May. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.